made of streams of orange, yellow, and red, and the matching headpiece that define this costume. Cinna plans to light them on fire just before our chariot rolls into the streets.
It's not real flame, of course. Just a little synthetic fire Portia and I came up with. You'll be perfectly safe, he says.
But I'm not convinced I won't be perfectly barbecued by the time we reach the city's center. My face is relatively clear of makeup, just a bit of highlighting here and there. My hair has been brushed out and then braided down my back in my usual style.
I want the audience to recognize you when you're in the arena, says Cinna dreamily.
Katniss, the girl who was on fire. It crosses my mind that Cinna's calm and normal demeanor masks a complete madman. Despite this morning's revelation about Peeta's character, I'm actually relieved when he shows up, dressed in an identical costume. He should know about fire, being a baker's son and all. His stylist, Portia, and her team accompany him, and everyone is absolutely giddy with excitement over what a splash we'll make. Except Cinna. He just seems a bit weary as he accepts congratulations.
We're whisked down to the bottom level of the Remake Center, which is essentially a gigantic stable. The opening ceremonies are about to start. Pairs of tributes are being loaded into chariots pulled by teams of four horses. Ours are coal black. The animals are so well trained, no one even needs to guide their reins.
Cinna and Portia direct us into the chariot and carefully arrange our body positions, the drape of our capes, before moving off to consult with each other.
What do you think? I whisper to Peeta. About the fire.
I'll rip off your cape if you'll rip off mine, he says through gritted teeth.
Deal, I say.
Maybe if we can get them off soon enough, we'll avoid the worst burns. It's bad enough, though. They'll throw us into the arena no matter what condition we're in.
I know we promised Haymitch we'd do exactly what they said, but I don't think he considered this angle.
Where is Haymitch anyway? Isn't he supposed to protect us from this sort of thing? Says Peeta.
With all that alcohol in him, it's probably not advisable to have him around an open flame, I say.
And suddenly we're both laughing. I guess we're both so nervous about the games, and more pressingly, petrified of being turned into human torches, we're not acting sensibly. The opening music begins. It's easy to hear, blasted around the capital. Massive doors slide open, revealing the crowd-lined streets. The ride lasts about 20 minutes and ends up at the city circle, where they will welcome us, play the anthem, and escort us into the training center, which will be our home-slash-prison until the games begin. The tributes from District 1 ride out in a chariot pulled by snow-white horses. They look so beautiful, spray-painted silver, in tasteful tunics glittering with jewels. District 1 makes luxury items for the capital. You can hear the roar of the crowd. They are always favorites. District 2 gets into position to follow them. In no time at all, we are approaching the door, and I can see that between the overcast sky and evening hour, the light is turning gray. The tributes from District 11 are just rolling out when Cinna appears with a lighted torch.
Here we go, then, he says,
and before we can react, he sets our capes on fire. I gasp, waiting for the heat. But there is only a faint tickling sensation. Cinna climbs up before us and ignites our headdresses. He lets out a sigh of relief.
It works.
Then he gently tucks a hand under my chin.
Remember, heads high, smiles. They're going to love you.
Cinna jumps off the chariot and has one last idea. He shouts something up at us, but the music drowns him out. He shouts again and gestures.
What's he saying? I ask Peeta.
For the first time, I look at him and realize that a blaze
with the fake flames. He is dazzling. And I must be, too.
I think he said for us to hold hands, says Peeta.
He grabs my right hand in his left, and we look to Cinna for confirmation. He nods and gives a thumbs up, and that's the last thing I see before we enter the city.
The crowd's initial alarm at our appearance quickly changes to cheers and shouts of District 12!
Every head is turned our way, pulling the focus from the three chariots ahead of us. At first, I'm frozen, but then I catch sight of us on a large television screen and am floored by how breathtaking we look. In the deepening twilight, the firelight illuminates our faces. We seem to be leaving a trail of fire off the flowing capes. Cinna was right about the minimal makeup. We both look more attractive, but utterly recognizable.
Remember, heads high, smiles. They're going to love you.
I hear Cinna's voice in my head. I lift my chin a bit higher, put on my most winning smile, and wave with my free hand. I'm glad now I have Peeta to clutch for balance. He is so steady, solid as a rock. As I gain confidence, I actually blow a few kisses to the crowd. The people of the capital are going nuts, showering us with flowers, shouting our names, our first names, which they have bothered to find on the program. The pounding music, the cheers, the admiration work their way into my blood, and I can't suppress my excitement. Cinna has given me a great advantage. No one will forget me. Not my look, not my name. Katniss, the girl who was on fire. For the first time, I feel a flicker of hope rising up in me. Surely, there must be one sponsor willing to take me on. And with a little extra help, some food, the right weapon, why should I cut myself out of the games? Someone throws me a red rose. I catch it, give it a delicate sniff, and blow a kiss back in the general direction of the giver. 100 hands reach up to catch my kiss, as if it were a real and tangible thing. Katniss! Katniss! I can hear my name being called from all sides. Everyone wants my kisses. It's not until we enter the city circle that I realize I must have completely stopped the circulation in Peeta's hand. That's how tightly I've been holding it. I look down at our linked fingers as I loosen my grasp, but he regains his grip on me.
No, don't let go of me, he says.
The firelight flickers off his blue eyes.
Please, I might fall out of this thing.
Okay, I say. So I keep holding on, but I can't help feeling strange about the way Cinna has linked us together. It's not really fair to present us as a team and then lock us into the arena to kill each other. The 12 chariots fill the loop of the city circle. On the buildings that surround the circle, every window is packed with the most prestigious citizens of the capital. Our horses pull our chariot right up to President Snow's mansion, and we come to a halt. The music ends with a flourish. The president, a small, thin man with paper-white hair, gives the official welcome from the balcony above us. It is traditional to cut away to the faces of the tributes during the speech. But I can see on the screen that we are getting way more than our share of airtime. The darker it becomes, the more difficult it is to take your eyes off our flickering. When the national anthem plays, they do not make an effort to do a quick cut around to each pair of tributes. But the camera holds on the District 12 chariot as it parades around the circle one final time and disappears into the training center. The doors have only just shut behind us when we're engulfed by the prep teams, who are nearly unintelligible as they babble out praise. As I glance around, I notice a lot of the other tributes are shooting us dirty looks, which confirms what I've suspected. We've literally outshone them all. Then Cinna and Portia are there, helping us down from the chariot, carefully removing our flaming capes and headdresses. Portia extinguishes them with some kind of spray from a canister. I realize I'm still glued to Peeta and force my stiff fingers to open. We both massage our hands.
"Thanks for keeping hold of me. I was getting a little shaky there," says Peeta.
"It didn't show," I tell him. "I'm sure no one noticed."
"I'm sure they didn't notice anything but you. You should wear flames more often," he says. "They suit you."
And then he gives me a smile that seems so genuinely sweet, with just the right touch of shyness, that unexpected warmth rushes through me. A warning bell goes off in my head. "Don't be so stupid. Peeta is planning how to kill you," I remind myself. "He is luring you in to make you easy prey. The more likable he is, the more deadly he is." But because two can play at this game, I stand on tiptoe and kiss his cheek, right on his bruise.
Chapter 6. The training center has a tower designed exclusively for the tributes and their teams. This will be our home until the actual games begin. Each district has an entire floor. You simply step onto an elevator and press the number of your district. Easy enough to remember. I've ridden the elevator a couple of times in the Justice Building back in District 12, once to receive the medal for my father's death, and then yesterday to say my final goodbyes to my friends and family. But that's a dark and creaky thing that moves like a snail and smells of sour milk. The walls of this elevator are made of crystal so that you can watch the people on the ground floor shrink to ants as you shoot up into the air. It's exhilarating, and I'm tempted to ask Effie Trinket if we can ride it again. But somehow that seems childish. Apparently, Effie Trinket's duties did not conclude at the station. She and Hamish will be overseeing us right into the arena. In a way, that's a plus, because at least she can be counted on to corral us around to places on time, whereas we haven't seen Hamish since he agreed to help us on the train. Probably passed out somewhere. Effie Trinket, on the other hand, seems to be flying high. We're the first team she's ever chaperoned that made a splash at the opening ceremonies. She's complimentary about not just our costumes, but how we conducted ourselves. And to hear her tell it, Effie knows everyone who's anyone in the capital, and has been talking us up all day, trying to win us sponsors.
"I've been very mysterious, though," she says, her eyes squint half shut. "Because, of course, Hamish hasn't bothered to tell me your strategies. But I've done my best with what I had to work with, how Katniss sacrificed herself for her sister, how you both successfully struggled to overcome the barbarism of your district."
Barbarism? That's ironic, coming from a woman helping to prepare us for slaughter. And what's she basing our success on? Our table manners?
"Everyone has their reservations, naturally, you being from the cold district. But I said, and this was very clever of me, I said, 'Well, if you put enough pressure on coal, it turns to pearls.'"
Effie beams at us so brilliantly that we have no choice but to respond enthusiastically to her cleverness, even though it's wrong. Coal doesn't turn to pearls. They grow in shellfish. Possibly she meant coal turns to diamonds, but that's untrue, too. I've heard they have some sort of machine in District 1 that can turn graphite into diamonds. But we don't mine graphite in District 12. That was part of District 13's job, until they were destroyed. I wonder if the people she's been plugging us to all day either know or care.
"Unfortunately, I can't seal the sponsor deals for you. Only Hamish can do that," says Effie grimly. "But don't worry. I'll get him to the table at gunpoint if necessary."
Although lacking in many departments, Effie Trinket
has a certain determination I have to admire. My quarters are larger than our entire house back home. They are plush, like the train car, but also have so many automatic gadgets that I'm sure I won't have time to press all the buttons. The shower alone has a panel with more than 100 options you can choose, regulating water temperature, pressure, soaps, shampoos, scents, oils, and massaging sponges. When you step out on a mat, heaters come on that blow dry your body. Instead of struggling with the knots in my wet hair, I merely place my hand on a box that sends a current through my scalp, untangling, parting, and drying my hair almost instantly. It floats down around my shoulders in a glossy curtain. I program the closet for an outfit to my taste. The windows zoom in and out on parts of the city at my command. You need only whisper a type of food from a gigantic menu into a mouthpiece, and it appears, hot and steamy, before you in less than a minute. I walk around the room eating goose liver and puffy bread until there's a knock on the door. Effie's calling me to dinner. Good. I'm starving. Peeta, Cinna, and Portia are standing out on a balcony that overlooks the Capitol when we enter the dining room. I'm glad to see the stylists, particularly after I hear that Haymitch will be joining us. A meal presided over by just Effie and Haymitch is bound to be a disaster. Besides, dinner isn't really about food, it's about planning out our strategies, and Cinna and Portia have already proven how valuable they are. A silent young man, dressed in a white tunic, offers us all stemmed glasses of wine. I think about turning it down, but I've never had wine, except the homemade stuff my mother uses for coughs, and when will I get a chance to try it again? I take a sip of the tart, dry liquid, and secretly think it could be improved by a few spoonfuls of honey. Haymitch shows up just as dinner is being served. It looks as if he's had his own stylist, because he's clean and groomed and about as sober as I've ever seen him. He doesn't refuse the offer of wine, but when he starts in on his soup, I realize it's the first time I've ever seen him eat. Maybe he really will pull himself together long enough to help us. Cinna and Portia seem to have a civilizing effect on Haymitch and Effie. At least they are addressing each other decently. And they both have nothing but praise for our stylist's opening act. While they make small talk, I concentrate on the meal. Mushroom soup, bitter greens with tomatoes the size of peas, rare roast beef sliced as thin as paper, noodles in a green sauce, cheese that melts on your tongue, served with sweet blue grapes. The servers, all young people, dressed in white tunics like the ones who gave us wine, move wordlessly to and from the table, keeping the platters and glasses full. About halfway through my glass of wine, my head starts feeling foggy, so I change to water instead. I don't like the feeling and hope it wears off soon. How Haymitch can stand walking around like this full time is a mystery. I try to focus on the talk, which has turned to our interview costumes, when a girl sets a gorgeous-looking cake on the table and deftly lights it. It blazes up, and then the flames flicker around the edges a while until it finally goes out. I have a moment of doubt. "What makes it burn? Is it alcohol?" I say, looking up at the girl. "That's the last thing I..." "Oh, I know you!" I can't place a name or time to the girl's face, but I'm certain of it. The dark red hair, the striking features, the porcelain white skin. But even as I utter the words, I feel my insides contracting with anxiety and guilt at the sight of her. And while I can't pull it up, I know some bad memory is associated with her. The expression of terror that crosses her face only adds to my confusion and unease. She shakes her head in denial quickly and hurries away from the table. When I look back, four adults are watching me like hawks.
"Don't be ridiculous, Katniss. How could you possibly know an Avox?"
snaps Effie.
"The very thought."
What's an AVOX? I ask stupidly. Someone who committed a crime. They cut her tongue so she can't speak, says Haymitch. She's probably a traitor of some sort. Not likely you'd know her.
And even if you did, you're not to speak to one of them unless it's to give an order, says Effie. Of course, you don't really know her.
But I do know her. And now that Haymitch has mentioned the word traitor, I remember from where. The disapproval is so high, I could never admit it. No, I guess not. I stammer, and the wine is not helping. Peter snaps his fingers.
Delly Cartwright. That's who it is. I kept thinking she looked familiar as well. Then I realized she's a dead ringer for Delly.
Delly Cartwright is a pasty-faced, lumpy girl with yellowish hair who looks about as much like our server as a beetle does a butterfly. She may also be the friendliest person on the planet. She smiles constantly at everybody in school, even me. I've never seen the girl with the red hair smile, but I jump on Peter's suggestion gratefully.
Of course, that's who I was thinking of. It must be the hair, I say.
Something about the eyes, too, says Peter. The energy at the table relaxes.
Oh, well, if that's all it is, says Cinna.
And yes, the cake has spirits, but all the alcohol is burned off. I ordered it specially in honor of your fiery debut. We eat the cake and move into a sitting room to watch the replay of the opening ceremonies that's being broadcast. A few of the other couples make a nice impression, but none of them can hold a candle to us. Even our own party lets out an ah as they show us coming out of the remake center.
Whose idea was the hand-holding? Asks Haymitch.
Cinna's, says Portia.
Just the perfect touch of rebellion, says Haymitch. Very nice.
Rebellion? I have to think about that one a moment. But when I remember the other couples, standing stiffly apart, never touching or acknowledging each other, as if their fellow tribute did not exist, as if the games had already begun, I know what Haymitch means. Presenting ourselves not as adversaries, but as friends, has distinguished us as much as the fiery costumes.
Tomorrow morning is the first training session. Meet me for breakfast, and I'll tell you exactly how I want you to play it, says Haymitch to Peter and I. Now, go get some sleep while the grown-ups talk.
Peter and I walk together down the corridor to our rooms. When we get to my door, he leans against the frame, not blocking my entrance exactly, but insisting I pay attention to him.
So, Delly Cartwright. Imagine finding her look-alike here.
He's asking for an explanation, and I'm tempted to give him one. We both know he covered for me. So here I am, in his debt again. If I tell him the truth about the girl, somehow that might even things up. How can it hurt, really? Even if he repeated the story, it couldn't do me much harm. It was just something I witnessed. And he lied as much as I did about Delly Cartwright. I realize I do want to talk to someone about the girl. Someone who might be able to help me figure out her story. Gail would be my first choice, but it's unlikely I'll ever see Gail again. I try to think if telling Peter could give him any possible advantage over me, but I don't see how. Maybe sharing a confidence will actually make him believe I see him as a friend. Besides, the idea of the girl with her maimed tongue frightens me. She has reminded me why I'm here. Not to model flashy costumes and eat delicacies, but to die a bloody death while the crowds urge on my killer. To tell or not to tell. My brain still feels slow from the wine. I stare down the empty corridor as if the decision lies there. Peter picks up on my hesitation. Have you been on the roof yet? I shake my head. Cinna showed me.
You can practically see the whole city. The wind's a bit loud, though.
I translate this into, "No one will overhear us talking," in my head.
You do have the sense that we might be under surveillance here.
Can we just go up?
Sure, come on, says Peeta.
I follow him to a flight of stairs that lead to the roof. There's a small dome-shaped room with a door to the outside. As we step into the cool, windy evening air, I catch my breath at the view. The capital twinkles like a vast field of fireflies. Electricity in District 12 comes and goes. Usually we only have it a few hours a day. Often the evenings are spent in candlelight. The only time you can count on it is when they're airing the games, or some important government message on television that it's mandatory to watch. But here, there would be no shortage ever. Peeta and I walk to a railing at the edge of the roof. I look straight down the side of the building to the street, which is buzzing with people. You can hear their cars, an occasional shout, and a strange metallic tinkling. In District 12, we'd all be thinking about bed right now.
I asked Cinna why they let us up here. Weren't they worried that some of the tributes might decide to jump right over the side? Says Peeta.
What'd he say? I ask.
You can't, says Peeta.
He holds out his hand into the seemingly empty space. There's a sharp zap, and he jerks it back.
Some kind of electric field throws you back on the roof.
Always worried about our safety, I say. Even though Cinna has shown Peeta the roof, I wonder if we're supposed to be up here now, so late and alone. I've never seen tributes on the training center roof before. But that doesn't mean we're not being taped.
Do you think they're watching us now?
Maybe,
he admits.
Come see the garden.
On the other side of the dome, they've built a garden with flower beds and potted trees. From the branches hang hundreds of wind chimes, which account for the tinkling I heard. Here in the garden, on this windy night, it's enough to drown out two people who are trying not to be heard. Peeta looks at me expectantly. I pretend to examine a blossom.
We were hunting in the woods one day, hidden, waiting for game. I whisper.
You and your father?
He whispers back.
No, my friend Gale. Suddenly all the birds stop singing at once, except one, as if it were giving a warning call. And then we saw her. I'm sure it was the same girl. A boy was with her. Their clothes were tattered. They had dark circles under their eyes from no sleep. They were running as if their lives depended on it, I say.
For a moment I'm silent as I remember how the sight of this strange pair, clearly not from District 12, fleeing through the woods immobilized us. Later, we wondered if we could have helped them escape. Perhaps we might have concealed them. If we'd moved quickly. Gale and I were taken by surprise, yes, but we're both hunters. We know how animals look at bay. We knew the pair was in trouble as soon as we saw them, but we only watched.
The hovercraft appeared out of nowhere,
I continued to Peeta.
I mean, one moment the sky is empty, and the next it was there. It didn't make a sound, but they saw it. A net dropped down on the girl and carried her up fast, so fast, like the elevator. They shot some sort of spear through the boy. It was attached to a cable, and they hauled him up as well. But I'm certain he was dead. We heard the girl scream once. The boy's name, I think. Then it was gone, the hovercraft, vanished into thin air. And the birds began to sing again, as if nothing had happened.
Did they see you? Peeta asked.
I don't know. We were under a shelf of rock,
I reply. But I do know. There was a moment, after the bird call, but before the hovercraft, where the girl had seen us. She'd locked eyes with me and called out for help. but neither Gale or I had responded.
"You're shivering," says Peeta.
The wind and the story have blown all the warmth from my body. The girl's scream, had it been her last? Peeta takes off his jacket and wraps it around my shoulders. I start to take a step back, but then I let him, deciding for a moment to accept both his jacket and his kindness. A friend would do that, right?
"They were from here?"
he asks, and he secures a button at my neck. I nod. They'd had that capital look about them, the boy and the girl.
"Where do you suppose they were going?"
he asks. "I don't know that," I say. "District 12 is pretty much the end of the line. Beyond us, there's only wilderness, if you don't count the ruins of District 13 that still smolder from the toxic bombs. They show it on television occasionally just to remind us. Or why they would leave here. Haymitch had called the Avoxes traitors. Against what? It could only be the capital. But they had everything here, no cause to rebel."
"I'd leave here," Peeta blurts out.
Then he looks around nervously. It was loud enough to hear above the chimes. He laughs.
"I'd go home now if they let me. But you have to admit, the food's prime."
He's covered again. If that's all you heard, it would just sound like the words of a scared tribute, not someone contemplating the unquestionable goodness of the capital.
"It's getting chilly. We better go in," he says.
Inside the dome, it's warm and bright. His tone is conversational.
"Your friend Gale. He's the one who took your sister away at the reaping."
"Yes. Do you know him?" I ask.
"Not really. I hear the girls talk about him a lot. I thought he was your cousin or something. You favor each other," he says.
"No, we're not related," I say. Peeta nods, unreadable.
"Did he come to say goodbye to you?"
"Yes," I say, observing him carefully. "So did your father. He brought me cookies." Peeta raises his eyebrows, as if this is news. But after watching him lie so smoothly, I don't give this much weight.
"Really? Well, he likes you and your sister. I think he wishes he had a daughter instead of a house full of boys."
The idea that I might ever have been discussed around the dinner table, at the bakery fire, just in passing in Peeta's house, gives me a start. It must have been when the mother was out of the room.
"He knew your mother when they were kids," says Peeta.
Another surprise, but probably true. "Oh, yes, she grew up in town," I say. It seems impolite to say that she never mentioned the baker, except to compliment his bread. We're at my door. I give back his jacket. "See you in the morning, then."
"See you,"
he says, and walks off down the hall. When I open my door, the red-headed girl is collecting my unitard and boots from where I left them on the floor before my shower. I want to apologize for possibly getting her in trouble earlier, but I remember I'm not supposed to speak to her unless I'm giving her an order. "Oh, sorry," I say. "I was supposed to get those back to Cinna. I'm sorry. Can you take them to him?" She avoids my eyes, gives a small nod, and heads out the door. I'd set out to tell her I was sorry about dinner, but I know that my apology runs much deeper, that I'm ashamed I never tried to help her in the woods, that I let the capital kill the boy and mutilate her without lifting a finger. Just like I was watching the games. I kick off my shoes and climb under the covers in my clothes. The shivering hasn't stopped. Perhaps the girl doesn't even remember me. But I know she does. You don't forget the face of the person who was your last hope. I pull the covers up over my head, as if this will protect me from the red-headed girl who can't speak. But I can feel her eyes staring at me, piercing through walls and doors and bedding. I wonder,
if she'll enjoy watching me die.
Chapter 7 My slumbers are filled with disturbing dreams. The face of the red-headed girl intertwines with gory images from earlier Hunger Games, with my mother withdrawn and unreachable, with Prim emaciated and terrified. I bolt up screaming for my father to run as the mine explodes into a million deadly bits of light. Dawn is breaking through the windows. The capital has a misty, haunted air. My head aches, and I must have bitten into the side of my cheek in the night. My tongue probes the ragged flesh, and I taste blood. Slowly, I drag myself out of bed and into the shower. I arbitrarily punch buttons on the control board, and end up hopping from foot to foot as alternating jets of icy cold and steaming hot water assault me. Then I'm deluged in lemony foam that I have to scrape off with a heavy bristled brush. Oh well, at least my blood is flowing. When I'm dried and moisturized with lotion, I find an outfit has been left for me at the front of the closet. Tight black pants, a long-sleeved burgundy tunic, and leather shoes. I put my hair in the single braid down my back. This is the first time since the morning of the reaping that I resemble myself. No fancy hair and clothes. No flaming capes. Just me, looking like I could be headed for the woods. It calms me. Haymitch didn't give us an exact time to meet for breakfast, and no one has contacted me this morning. But I'm hungry, so I head down to the dining room, hoping there will be food. I'm not disappointed. While the table is empty, a long board off to the side has been laid with at least 20 dishes. A young man, an Avox, stands at attention by the spread. When I ask if I can serve myself, he nods assent. I load a plate with eggs, sausages, batter cakes covered in thick orange preserves, slices of pale purple melon. As I gorge myself, I watch the sun rise over the capital. I have a second plate of hot grain smothered in beef stew. Finally, I fill a plate with rolls and sit at the table, breaking off bits and dipping them into hot chocolate the way Peeta did on the train. My mind wanders to my mother and Prim. They must be up. My mother getting their breakfast of mush. Prim milking her goat before school. Just two mornings ago, I was home. Can that be right? Yes, just two. And now how empty the house feels, even from a distance. What did they say last night about my fiery debut at the games? Did it give them hope, or simply add to their terror when they saw the reality of 24 tributes circled together, knowing only one could live? Haymitch and Peeta come in. Bid me good morning, fill their plates. It makes me irritated that Peeta is wearing exactly the same outfit I am. I need to say something to Cinna. This twins act is going to blow up in our faces once the games begin. Surely they must know this. Then I remember Haymitch telling me to do exactly what the stylists tell me to do. If it was anyone but Cinna, I might be tempted to ignore him. But after last night's triumph, I don't have a lot of room to criticize his choices. I'm nervous about the training. There will be 3 days in which all the tributes practice together. On the last afternoon, we'll each get a chance to perform in private before the game makers. The thought of meeting the other tributes face to face makes me queasy. I turn the roll I have just taken from the basket over and over in my hands, but my appetite is gone. When Haymitch has finished several platters of stew, he pushes back his plate with a sigh. He takes a flask from his pocket and takes a long pull on it and leans his elbows on the table.
So let's get down to business. Training. First off, if you like, I'll coach you separately. Decide now.
Why would you coach us separately? I ask.
Say if you had a secret skill you might not want the other to know about. Says Haymitch.
I exchange a look with Peter.
I don't have any secret skills, he says. And I already know what yours is, right? I mean, I've eaten enough of your squirrels.
I never thought about Peter eating the squirrels I shot. Somehow I always pictured the baker quietly going off and frying them up for himself. Not out of greed, but because town families usually eat expensive butcher meat, beef and chicken and horse.
You can coach us together, I tell Hamish.
Peter nods.
All right, so give me some idea of what you can do, says Hamish. I can't do anything, says Peter, unless you count baking bread. Sorry, I don't. Katniss, I already know you're handy with a knife, says Hamish.
Not really, but I can hunt, I say, with a bow and arrow.
And you're good? Asks Hamish.
I have to think about it. I've been putting food on the table for 4 years. That's no small task. I'm not as good as my father was, but he'd had more practice. I've better aim than Gale, but I've had more practice. He's a genius with traps and snares. I'm all right, I say.
She's excellent, says Peter. My father buys her squirrels. He always comments on how the arrows never pierce the body. She hits everyone in the eye. It's the same with the rabbits she sells to the butcher. She can even bring down a deer.
This assessment of my skills from Peter takes me totally by surprise. First, that he ever noticed. Second, that he's talking me up. What are you doing? I ask him suspiciously.
What are you doing?
If he's going to help you, he has to know what you're capable of. Don't underrate yourself, says Peter. I don't know why, but this rubs me the wrong way.
What about you? I've seen you in the market. You can lift 100-pound bags of flour, I snap at him. Tell him that. That's not nothing.
Yes, and I'm sure the arena will be full of bags of flour for me to chuck at people.
It's not like being able to use a weapon. You know it isn't. He shoots back.
He can wrestle, I tell Hamish. He came in second in our school competition last year, only after his brother.
What use is that? How many times have you seen someone wrestle someone to death? Says Peter in disgust.
There's always hand-to-hand combat. All you need is to come up with a knife, and you'll at least stand a chance. If I get jumped, I'm dead!
I can hear my voice rising in anger.
But you won't. You'll be living up in some tree eating raw squirrels and picking off people with arrows. You know what my mother said to me when she came to say goodbye? As if to cheer me up? She says maybe District 12 will finally have a winner.
Then I realized she didn't mean me. She meant you, bursts out Peter.
Oh, she meant you, I say with a wave of dismissal.
She said, she's a survivor, that one.
She is, says Peter.
That pulls me up short. Did his mother really say that about me? Did she rate me over her son? I see the pain in Peter's eyes. I know he isn't lying. Suddenly, I'm behind the bakery, and I can feel the chill of rain running down my back, the hollowness in my belly. I sound 11 years old when I speak. But only because someone helped me.
Peter's eyes flicker down to the roll in my hands, and I know he remembers that day too. But he just shrugs.
People will help you in the arena. They'll be tripping over each other to sponsor you.
No more than you, I say.
Peter rolls his eyes at Hamish.
She has no idea the effect she can have.
He runs his fingernail along the wood grain in the table, refusing to look at me.
What on earth does he mean? People help me? When we were dying of starvation, no one helped me. No one except Peter.
Once I had something to barter with, things changed. I'm a tough trader. Or am I? What effect do I have? That I'm weak, needy? Is he suggesting that I got good deals because people pitied me? I try to think that this is true. Perhaps some of the merchants were a little generous in their trades, but I always attributed that to their long-standing relationship with my father. Besides, my game is first class. No one pitied me. I glower at the roll. Sure, he meant to insult me. After about a minute of this, Haymitch says,
"Well, then, well, well, well. Katniss, there's no guarantee there'll be bows and arrows in the arena, but during your private session with the game makers, show them what you can do. Till then, stay clear of archery. Are you any good at trapping?"
"I know a few basic snares," I mutter.
"That may be significant in terms of food," says Haymitch. "And Peeta, she's right. Never underestimate strength in the arena. Very often, physical power tilts the advantage to a player. In the training center, they'll have weights, but don't reveal how much you can lift in front of the other tributes. The plan's the same for both of you. You go to group training, spend the time trying to learn something you don't know. Throw a spear, swing a mace, learn to tie a decent knot. Save showing what you're best at until your private sessions." "Are we clear?" says Haymitch.
Peeta and I nod.
"One last thing. In public, I want you by each other's side every minute," says Haymitch.
We both start to object, but Haymitch slams his hand on the table.
"Every minute! It's not open for discussion. You agreed to do as I said. You will be together. You will appear amiable to each other. Now get out. Meet Effie at the elevator at 10 for training."
I bite my lip and stalk back to my room, making sure Peeta can hear the door slam. I sit on the bed, hating Haymitch, hating Peeta, hating myself for mentioning that day long ago in the rain. It's such a joke. Peeta and I going along, pretending to be friends, talking up each other's strengths, insisting the other take credit for their abilities. Because in fact, at some point, we're going to have to knock it off and accept we're bitter adversaries. Which I'd be prepared to do right now if it wasn't for Haymitch's stupid instruction that we stick together in training. It's my own fault, I guess, for telling him he didn't have to coach us separately. But that didn't mean I wanted to do everything with Peeta, who, by the way, clearly doesn't want to be partnering up with me either. I hear Peeta's voice in my head. She has no idea the effect she can have. Obviously meant to demean me, right? But a tiny part of me wonders if this was a compliment, that he meant I was appealing in some way. It's weird how much he's noticed me, like the attention he's paid to my hunting. And apparently, I have not been as oblivious to him as I imagined either. The flower, the wrestling, I have kept track of the boy with the bread. It's almost 10. I clean my teeth and smooth back my hair again. Anger temporarily blocked out my nervousness about meeting the other tributes, but now I can feel my anxiety rising again. By the time I meet Effie and Peeta at the elevator, I catch myself biting my nails. I stop at once. The actual training rooms are below ground level of our building. With these elevators, the ride is less than a minute. The doors open into an enormous gymnasium filled with various weapons and obstacle courses. Although it's not yet 10, we're the last ones to arrive. The other tributes are gathered in a tense circle. They each have a cloth square with their district number on it pinned to their shirts. While someone pins the number 12 on my back, I do a quick assessment. Peeta and I are the only two dressed alike. As soon as we join the circle, the head trainer, a tall, athletic woman named Itala, steps up and begins to explain the training schedule. Experts in each skill will remain at their stations. We will be free to travel from area to area as we choose, per our mentor's instructions.
Some of the stations teach survival skills, others fighting techniques. We are forbidden to engage in any combative exercise with another tribute. There are assistants on hand if we want to practice with a partner. When Atala begins to read down the list of the skill stations, my eyes can't help flitting around to the other tributes. It's the first time we've been assembled on level ground in simple clothes. My heart sinks. Almost all of the boys and at least half of the girls are bigger than I am, even though many of the tributes have never been fed properly. You can see it in their bones, their skin, the hollow look in their eyes. I may be smaller naturally, but overall my family's resourcefulness has given me an edge in that area. I stand straight, and while I'm thin, I'm strong. The meat and plants from the woods, combined with the exertion it took to get them, have given me a healthier body than most of those I see around me. The exceptions are the kids from the wealthier districts, the volunteers, the ones who have been fed and trained throughout their lives for this moment. The tributes from 1, 2, and 4 traditionally have this look about them. It's technically against the rules to train tributes before they reach the capital, but it happens every year. In District 12, we call them the career tributes, or just the careers. And like as not, the winner will be one of them. The slight advantage I held coming into the training center, my fiery entrance last night, seems to vanish in the presence of my competition. The other tributes were jealous of us, but not because we were amazing, because our stylists were. Now I see nothing but contempt in the glances of the career tributes. Each must have 50 to 100 pounds on me. They project arrogance and brutality. When Atala releases us, they head straight for the deadliest-looking weapons in the gym and handle them with ease. I'm thinking that it's lucky I'm a fast runner when Peeta nudges my arm and I jump. He is still beside me, per Haymitch's instructions. His expression is sober.
Where would you like to start?
I look around at the career tributes who are showing off, clearly trying to intimidate the field. Then at the others, the underfed, the incompetent, shakily having their first lessons with a knife or an axe.
Suppose we tie some knots, I say.
Right you are, says Peeta.
We cross to an empty station where the trainer seems pleased to have students. You get the feeling that the knot-tying class is not the Hunger Games hot spot. When he realizes I know something about snares, he shows us a simple, excellent trap that will leave a human competitor dangling by a leg from a tree. We concentrate on this one skill for an hour until both of us have mastered it. Then we move on to camouflage. Peeta genuinely seems to enjoy this station, swirling a combination of mud and clay and berry juices around on his pale skin, weaving disguises from vines and leaves. The trainer who runs the camouflage station is full of enthusiasm at his work.
I do the cakes, he admits to me.
The cakes? I ask. I've been preoccupied with watching the boy from District 2 send a spear through a dummy's heart from 15 yards.
What cakes?
At home, the iced ones, for the bakery, he says.
He means the ones they display in the windows. Fancy cakes with flowers and pretty things painted in frosting. They're for birthdays and New Year's Day. When we're in the square, Prim always drags me over to admire them, although we'd never be able to afford one. There's little enough beauty in District 12, though, so I can hardly deny her this. I look more critically at the design on Peeta's arm. The alternating pattern of light and dark suggests sunlight falling through the leaves in the woods. I wonder how he knows this, since I doubt he's ever been beyond the fence. Has he been able to pick this up from just that scraggly old apple tree in his backyard? Somehow the whole thing, his skill, those inaccessible cakes,
the praise of the camouflage expert annoys me.
It's lovely, if only you could frost someone to death, I say.
Don't be so superior. You can never tell what you'll find in the arena.
Say it's actually a gigantic cake, begins Peeta.
Say we move on, I break in.
So the next 3 days pass with Peeta and I going quietly from station to station. We do pick up some valuable skills, from starting fires to knife throwing to making shelter. Despite Haymitch's order to appear mediocre, Peeta excels in hand-to-hand combat, and I sweep the edible plants test without blinking an eye.
We steer clear of archery and weightlifting, though, wanting to save those for our private sessions. The game makers appeared early on the first day. 20 or so men and women dressed in deep purple robes. They sit in the elevated stands that surround the gymnasium, sometimes wandering about to watch us, jotting down notes, other times eating at the endless banquet that has been set for them, ignoring the lot of us. But they do seem to be keeping their eye on the District 12 tributes. Several times I've looked up to find one fixated on me. They consult with the trainers during our meals as well. We see them all gathered together when we come back. Breakfast and dinner are served on our floor, but at lunch, the 24 of us eat in a dining room off the gymnasium. Food is arranged on carts around the room, and you serve yourself. The career tributes tend to gather rowdily around one table, as if to prove their superiority, that they have no fear of one another and consider the rest of us beneath notice. Most of the other tributes sit alone, like lost sheep. No one says a word to us. Peeta and I eat together, and since Haymitch keeps dogging us about it, try to keep up a friendly conversation during the meals. It's not easy to find a topic. Talking of home is painful. Talking of the present, unbearable. One day, Peeta empties out our bread basket and points out how they have been careful to include types from the districts, along with the refined bread of the capital. The fish-shaped loaf, tinted green with seaweed, from District 4. The crescent moon roll, dotted with seeds, from District 11. Somehow, although it's made from the same stuff, it looks a lot more appetizing than the ugly drop biscuits that are the standard fare at home.
And there you have it, says Peeta, scooping the breads back in the basket.
You certainly know a lot, I say.
Only about bread, he says. Okay, now laugh as if I've said something funny.
We both give a somewhat convincing laugh and ignore the stares from around the room.
All right, I'll keep smiling pleasantly and you talk, says Peeta.
It's wearing us both out. Haymitch's direction to be friendly. Because ever since I slammed my door, there's been a chill in the air between us. But we have our orders.
Did I ever tell you about the time I was chased by a bear? I ask.
No, but it sounds fascinating, says Peeta.
I try and animate my face as I recall the event. A true story, in which I'd foolishly challenged a black bear over the rights to a beehive. Peeta laughs and asks questions right on cue. He's much better at this than I am. On the second day, while we're taking a shot at spear throwing, he whispers to me,
I think we have a shadow.
I throw my spear, which I'm not too bad at, actually, if I don't have to throw too far, and see the little girl from District 11 standing back a bit, watching us. She's the 12-year-old, the one who reminded me so of Prim in stature. Up close, she looks about 10. She has bright, dark eyes and satiny brown skin, and stands tilted up on her toes with her arms slightly extended to her sides, as if ready to take wing at the slightest sound. It's impossible not to think of a bird. I pick up another spear while Peeta throws.
I think her name's Rue, he says softly.
I bite my lip. Rue is a small yellow flower that grows in the meadow. Rue, primrose. Neither of them could tip the scale at 70.